So this morning we begin two-hour lectures only on the Song of Songs. It's unique in the Bible, and you'll get the reasons already if you don't know them already. It's unique because it's the only poem, song, that is explicitly rejoicing in sexual love, which is great, really, because, I don't know, religion sometimes and sex get a bit distant and it can be a bit iffy and people get all anxious about it. Whereas here we have a Jewish song that simply celebrates it. Of course, it's appropriate love, but it's celebrated with love. So that's what makes me very excited about sharing this couple of times with you. Okay, now called the Song of Songs in English, that's Shir Shirim. It's a superlative. It's a superlative form in Hebrew, translated into English. So it just means the songest, the best song. It's indicating esteem that the editors of it had for this particular song. So they're claiming that this rich collection of lyric songs has a preeminent place, and the verse goes on, the Song of Solomon, of Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. So it links with the name of Solomon. Come back to that in a moment. When was the Song of Songs written? I think the most honest thing to say that nobody really knows. It's got Aramaisms in it, which are the Aram, that's the language of the after the Persians took over 520, you know, Cyrus of Persia, you've done with me earlier. When they took over, Aramaic, which is the language of Syria, became the lingua franca of the Persian Empire, though each area had its own language, of course. So it's not Persian, it's Aramaic. And when the people came back from exile, they came back speaking Aramaic, which was like Hebrew. In fact, Hebrew uses the Aramaic alphabet. But it's a bigger language, and it's got a lot of similarities, but it's not the same. And there's quite a few Aramaisms in the Song of Songs, which is a pointer, according to some scholars, that it was written after the exile. So, but it's only a pointer, because it's not impossible that Aramaic Syrian language could well have affected the northern part of Israel, because that's what happens when countries are contiguous. So Aramaisms don't necessarily mean it could be a northern dialect even. So we have to leave ourselves in a little bit of doubt about that. It does have, however, some Persian loan words in it. Well, Persian loan words, there's no reason for those to have got into the language till Persia, that Cyrus of Persia, took over. So it's another pointer to it being during the Persian period. And it shows no influence of Greek. So all of that, for those who are interested, seems to point that it was written sometime between 500 and 300 BC. However, the song we don't need to know when it was written, because it's actually quite independent of the time, and it speaks about the subject without reference to anything around it. So internally, there's no evidence to place it in any historical situation. Why is it applied to Solomon? Well, the attribution to Solomon, you'll find here, we've just seen it, but it's also in the book of Proverbs. And two of the big sections of Proverbs begin with the Proverbs of Solomon. Also, the book of Ecclesiastes, which we'll look at, God willing, in 3 weeks' time, or 2 weeks' time, is also said to be of Solomon. In the Greek Bible, that is the Greek version of the Hebrew Bible, there's also another book called the Book of Wisdom, written in the 1st century BC, the latest of the books of the Jewish, but the Greek Jewish Bible, and that's also the Wisdom of Solomon. So we've got three books, Song of Songs, Ecclesiastes, Proverbs, and Wisdom, four, that are attributed to this man, Solomon. Best way to explain that is to have a look at the Book of Kings. And there are three references there. Chapter 4, verse 32 reads, Solomon composed 3,000 proverbs and his songs numbered 1,005. Well, I was going to say it's a pretty big generalisation, but the five knocks you round a bit. Now, please remember, the Book of Kings, the final edition, would have been 400 years after Solomon. So we're dealing with legendary material here. Like, he was the figure that they looked on as the one full of wisdom. Mind you, he slipped a bit through his life, as you might know. Chapter 4, verse 29 of Kings says, God gave Solomon very great wisdom, discernment and breadth of understanding as vast as the sand on the seashore. And a little later in the same book, King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. So the reputation, the legend about the son of David, right back in the beginnings of our historical period, but written centuries later from oral tradition and stories and who knows what, is that this Solomon was renowned for his wisdom. And here we have the wisdom books of the Bible attributed to him. Just as David was renowned for his music. He was playing in the court of Saul, and so all the Psalms are attributed, as you know, to David. So it's an attribution, not claiming authorship, but just he's the figure under which they all kind of gather. In the New Testament, the same legend applies. In Matthew chapter 12, verse 42, Jesus says, as reported by the Matthew, of course, the Queen of the South, that's the Queen of Sheba, will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, because she came from the ends of the earth to listen to the wisdom of Solomon. Well, that story is found in the Bible, and Jesus is simply talking about it, as we would talk about the story of the prodigal son. It doesn't mean there was a prodigal son and he had a father and you could name him. And it's not saying that, but Jesus is quoting the legend, quoting the story. And he says, but a greater than Solomon is here. So they came from the ends of the earth to listen to Solomon. And here's Jesus presented, of course, by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and particularly John as the wisdom of God made incarnate. People are just not listening when he tells them about who God is. So by attributing it to Solomon, the editors of the book, who included in their sacred texts, their canon of their scriptures, are saying, this is authoritative wisdom. So, since the subject of the book is love between a woman and a man, with the primary perspective being that of the woman, the link with Solomon and so with wisdom prepares us for a song, now it's up to each of us to find this, which will offer us wisdom about sexual love. That's what we should expect when we open this text. So the reader is left in no doubt that the yearning, the discovery, the joy of discovery, the delight of consummation are part and a significant part of the creation which God looks upon and sees to be very good. And you know that from the book of Genesis. Creation is very good, including particularly man and woman, and their sexual love, of course, is included in that as being very good. So that's a good place to start, because some of us might have in our early training, through the insecurity of our teachers, might have started by thinking sex was actually pretty dangerous, which I presume it is, but also not necessarily all that good. A bit of negativity comes in all religions, some more than others, of course. So we're reminded of the statement in the book of Genesis that it's as male and female that God created in the image of God. Genesis 2 verse 7 says, let us make man in our own image, etc. And then it's not good to be alone. So God made, you know, the story of the rib, and because the word in rib in the Eastern Chaldean is like the word for life. They're kind of pun on each other. So they've got the rib and the woman, etc. And the first words of the human being in the book of Genesis that man ever speaks are spoken by Adam, and all you men will understand this, when God created all these animals, etc., to come along to give Adam company. And Adam was thinking, oh, yeah, they're all right, but not much company for me. And then finally God got the bright idea, you'd think he could have started with this one, of creating woman. And listen to it, Adam's first words, the first word of a human being in the whole story is, zoot. And then he repeats it, zoot, you know, like he can't get over, this is good stuff. But, so, you know, that's what, and we all understand that. We hear the delight in Adam's voice when at last God gives him Eve as his companion. Of course it's only a story, but it's a story about everybody's, hopefully, love. It's a story about the Song of Songs. There are other love poems in the ancient world, Egypt, Babylon, not many, but they exist. But there's no other book from the ancient world that talks about this sexual love from the woman's perspective. She's the one who does nearly all the talking. Now, that's not usual. in poetry, it's not. Okay. So the Song of Songs, however, before I start into it, has a long history of being interpreted as offering a lyrical expression of the intimacy that God offers the community, as well as the personal communion with God that can be enjoyed by each believer. You can see why that would happen, but that was the interpretation that probably accounts for it being in our canon of the ancient scriptures, because of the way it was interpreted as a metaphor but what a lovely metaphor, for the relationship of God and us. I'll give you some examples of that before I get into the text. While God is not explicitly mentioned in these songs, and that's kind of good, they're not theologizing, they're talking about sexual love. So God isn't mentioned explicitly, but the song is used, and that's why I've got it in my book called The Festival Scrolls. The Jewish practice is to sing this song at the Feast of Passover, which we've just been through. So it's attached to the liberation of the people from Egypt and so on. The fact that they put it in there witnesses to a religious application of the love metaphor to the union of Israel with Yahweh. It was read in this way by Rabbi Akiba, who had a lot to do with the finalizing of the canon of the Jewish, the Hebrew, Palestinian canon of scriptures. Philo, who was a first century mystical kind of Jewish writer from Alexandria, and we've got a lot of his work, this is how he interprets it. And the famous Maimonides, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon of the 12th century, a Jewish rabbi, and it was St. Thomas who read his writings and introduced Aristotle into the University of Paris in 1200. So that was a big breakthrough in theology, as they incorporated the... up till then, it was Plato was the main source of theological reflection, and Plato is a little bit abstract, whereas Aristotle was a scientist, a physicist, and was into, what are they called, evidence-based reality. Marvellous mind, incredible. And Thomas picked this up, exciting stuff, introduced it to the university. So what have we done? We've canonised St. Thomas now, can be. All my studies were done in Thomistic philosophy, for example, and that wasn't that long ago. Well, it was 50 years ago I finished. But the seminary was all that, and good, wonderful stuff. But what about all the stuff we've found, like the need for the church's theology to keep picking up on the discoveries of science, of course, is obvious to you all, but we've got to keep alert to this. And the great minds of the past, that's what they were doing. They were connecting with their world, and that brought a whole new, fresh way of looking at the mysteries of faith. And it still should be going on, and still is going on. So these are the Jewish people. There are plenty of others. And there are instances in the Hebrew scriptures of God being compared to a bridegroom and Israel to a bride. You'll know them, but let me read some of them to you. Isaiah chapter 62, God speaking to his people. And because God is imagined as male, God isn't male, of course, but God is imagined as male, and in the ancient world that had to be the case, and it had to be the case right through till the Enlightenment, in a way. If I could give you the reason, because once you see the reason, it's very simple, because they misunderstood biology. They had basically no concept of the woman contributing the female zygote, you know, to the human being. They thought the male seed was life, and that he just placed it in the woman, the way a tree puts a seed in the ground and the ground nurtures it. So with that understanding, of course, you couldn't possibly metaphorically imagine God as female, because that would make God the receiver of life. Do you get it? Mm-hmm. Whereas God is actually the giver of life. Ergo, masculine, male. But we know now that's wrong, obviously. It's neither male nor female. So here you've got God imagined in the life-giver aspect of loving, that's the male aspect, and ourselves as the community receiving grace, all of us as a body, female, because we're receiving this grace from God. And it reads, "You shall be called, my delight is in her." Hephzibah, that's what that is in Hebrew. "And your land will be called Beulah, married. For Yahweh delights in you, your land shall be married." This covenant of love and commitment. "For as a young man marries a young woman, so shall your builder, the one building you up, marry you. And as a bridegroom rejoices in his bride, so shall your God rejoice over you." There's many more. Not many more, there's half a dozen more, but I think that gives you the idea, I hope, enough. Now, Christian writers have read these poems as offering a lyrical expression of the intimacy that God offers the community. They picked it up from their Jewish training, of course. An expression of the union of Christ and the church, of which marriage is a sacrament. It is the sacrament of love. Paul to the Ephesians, "Husbands, love your wives." And now we come back again, hold it. Because when you read anything Paul says about marriage, you know, I hope, you've got to ask, what was marriage in the first century? What was he dealing with? What was he talking about? When people read Paul's letters, how did they read it? But without that, you can't possibly quote from it or apply it to anything. And in their world, typically, a girl would be married as soon as she could be, 12, 13, 14. And the man would be 10 years old at least. He had to get a job, he had to be able to earn his living, and mum and dad weren't going to give their daughter to some yobo who couldn't earn a living. So he had to have studied. You got the picture? So that's the marriage situation. And then the girl, from the protection of her father, was handed over to the protection of her husband. And she lived in the home. Outside, in a way, she was invisible. She was the home builder, she was the lover, she was the mother. I mean, what better things can you be? But in the social fabric of the world, she was not visible and didn't want to be and wasn't trained to be, etc., etc. So that's the situation. Now, when Paul writes his letters, he's writing to that situation and he's assuming it. He's not saying it's good or bad. It's the culture and everyone's doing it. So he's not questioning it, but he's saying, okay, husbands, love your wives. Just as, what a lovely thing to say, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. So, husbands, give yourself up for your wives. Give your life for them. Don't just treat them as a possession or a chattel or something you happen to own or can skite about. In order to make her holy, by cleansing her with the washing of water and the word, that's baptism, so that she may be holy and without blemish, Christ nourishes and tenderly cares for the church, because we are members of his body, following the same Jewish idea. and a wonderful scene, the book of Revelation, which is chaotic unless you understand it, but once you do understand it and get the key to it, it's a pretty simple book really, and it leads to this extraordinary conclusion, this paradise that ends in, I saw, the last thing he saw, the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven. And what's he talking about? He's talking about the community at Ephesus, at Thyatira, you know, the seven cities, seven churches of the Asia Minor area where he lived. He's talking about Yarralumla, and he's talking about Everett and Kippax, and where are you from?
Canberra.
Canberra. Well, of course he's talking about Canberra. So yeah, he's talking about the local community. That's the New Jerusalem. That's us. That's you. Coming in late and some coming in shorts and some coming in this and that. That's okay. We come as we are and we come in and we are, you are, as you gather in your church, you are the New Jerusalem. That's what he's talking about. He's trying to help people to look at who they really are. I saw the holy, it's not something up there happening in the clouds, coming down out of heaven, of course, out of God. It's God inspired. Prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. The city has no need of sun or moon to shine on it. The glory of God is its light. Its lamp is the Lamb. The nations will walk by its light. That's what the church has got to be, supposed to be, should be, partly is. I don't know if it's 20% that or 80%, I wouldn't like to say, but we should be 100% that, you lot, shouldn't we? I mean, that's what the church should be. Everyone should be looking at the church and thinking, my God, that's marvellous, why can't we live like that? But I'm in it, so you've got to pull it back for a bit and you're in it. Nations will walk by its light and the kings of the earth will bring their glory to it. Its gates will never be shut by day. There'll be no night there. People will bring into it the glory and the honour of the nations. All the people over Easter that entered into the full communion with the Catholic Church and brought the riches of their Presbyterian background, or they might have been Hindus, or they might have been Buddhists, whatever, they bring in all this rich stuff and the church is refreshed with all this new life. Some people get the idea you've got to leave it all behind and join this mob. God, don't do that. Bring your riches in and we think, oh God, thank you, we're much better now with you. Do you know what I mean? You know how it works, don't you? People will bring into it the glory and the honour of the nations. Think of St. Patrick, I can't help talk about him. Brought the eye. I mean, he had the gift of communicating the faith to this mob, and there still are the Irish. I mean, I'm only one step away from it all, but he brought it in, but he captured their imagination, didn't he? Marvellously. And many of us are still benefiting from that. So we've got to capture the imagination of the new generation so that they see, wow, this is about freedom, life, intuition, or the Spirit. Now, a lovely ending. The Spirit and the Bride say, come. To the risen Christ, come. The Spirit is in the church, the singing of the church. Let everyone who hears it say, come. Let everyone who is thirsty, come. Let everyone who wishes take the water of life free as a gift. So these songs have also been interpreted as a lyrical expression of the personal community, not just the community now, but you, each of you and me, our personal communion with God that can be enjoyed by each believer. 2 Corinthians 11:2, I promised you, says Paul, in marriage to one husband to present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. And the final part of my introduction, then I'll pause and you can have some questions if you want. Bernard of Clairvaux, marvellous fellow, Bernard, whatever. See, he did something too. He caught the imagination of his community. When, at the beginning of the century, these are the, what do you call them? Benedict goes, that's right. No, I know, but it won't come. Poor old Brian. Tell me, St. Bernard was a Cistercian, yeah, but then of a special. So he, at the beginning of the century, there were none of them. At the end of the century, there were 1,000 monasteries all through Europe. Like, it just did something that people thought, yes, 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 that's it. And that's our job, is to say, get the next generation and our own brothers and sisters and that to say, oh, that's it, and do it. Well, everybody, by the way, in the early... There's no book of the Bible that has more commentaries on it than the Song of Songs. And I think I know why. You've got all these, the male celibates, thinking, oh, well, can't have the real thing, I'll have the Song of Songs. So they interpret it, like, there's a bit of that in it, I think. It's the kind of their, they just take it sublime, they sublimate this sexual drive, which is the energy we've all got, and they take it into an area of love of God and love of, which is a great thing to do. Well, here's St. Bernard, for example, in his sermon 79 of 80 sermons on the Song of Songs. Who is it whom your soul loves? For whom do you inquire? Has he no name? Who are you? Who is he? In this marriage song, that's we're going to start it in a few minutes, it's affections, not words, that are to be considered. You do know, don't you, that the word believe in English, so it's very good, comes from two words of origins of our B-E, of course, is B, and L-I-E-V-E comes German, ich liebe dich, Dutch, liefde. Is that right? Believe is to be in love. So people start fighting about concepts of God. We grab this mystery of God who's at the heart of everything, bring it into our tiny little bloody brains, think we can control it, and then fight over our thoughts about God. I mean, it's bizarre. So it's important to have good thoughts and not bad thoughts. It's important that wrong thoughts be corrected. All of that's important because we've got a reason and we've got to use it to its full extent. But when we get into this mystery, it's something other that's being caught, just as it is in love. Well, who are you? Who is he? In this marriage song, says Bernard, it's affections, not words, that are to be considered. Why is this? Except that the holy love, which is the subject of the entire song, cannot be expressed by words, but only in deed and in truth, quoting Jesus' words to Nicodemus, in action, in communication, in connection, in loving. Here love speaks everywhere. If you desire to grasp these writings, you must love. Could I say, verticum, you must believe. For anyone who doesn't love, it's useless to listen to this song of love. For a cold heart cannot catch fire from its eloquence.